You're back with Total Information AM. I'm Megan Lynch. Our next guest has taken geospatial science to the depths of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean to be exact. Dr. Don Wright is chief scientist of ESRI. Her story is featured in a new book, Mapping the Deep, and she joins me now. Thank you so much, Dr. Wright, for being with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Megan. I'm very, very pleased to be with you.
So first off, for our listeners who might not be familiar, what is ESRI and what's your role as chief scientist?
ESRI is actually an acronym. It stands for Environmental Systems Research Institute, and we are a privately held geospatial mapping and spatial data science company. And I serve as the chief scientist for that company, which means that I'm the main science strategist for our CEO, Jack Dangerman. And I also foster a program to do research and development projects with our partners and to represent ESRI on various scientific boards and councils. I'm basically the science ninja, the science liaison between ESRI and the scientific community.
Tell us how you got involved in this incredible voyage to one of the deepest parts of the ocean, the Mariana Trench.
Yes, it's really a case of friends connecting friends. So for many years, we have worked very closely with NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. And for many of those years, we have had a nice relationship with Kathy Sullivan, who was the administrator for NOAA. And NOAA is one of the biggest national government users of our software. Now, Kathy Sullivan was invited by Victor Vescovo to go on an earlier expedition to Challenger Deep, especially to allow her to be the first woman to go to Challenger Deep. And this is wonderful because she is also the first American woman to walk in space. And to support her dive, Caladan Oceanic, the organization that did these wonderful expeditions, asked us at ESRI to support the mapping for the expedition. And we weren't able to do that because of the pandemic, but and this was in 2020. But in 2021, Caladan Oceanic, through Victor Vescovo, came back to ask me if I would like to go, especially since the relationship between Kathy was great in terms of mapping software, and Caladan Oceanic is actually a user of our technology as well. But Victor Vescovo dug a little deeper into my background and found out about my history with deep sea submersible diving, and asked me if I would like to go on a special project to Challenger Deep. And so that's how that came about.
You have to describe the experience for our listeners. I've seen the video of the craft that you were in. It looks tiny on the inside. I'm sure it was loaded with instruments. Just describe that experience, the descent, and the risks that entailed.
Yes, it is a tiny craft. The craft is called the Limiting Factor, and it's the only submersible of its kind. It's the only piece of technology that can take human beings repeatedly to any part of the ocean, including the deepest parts. It was designed specifically for that. And as such, it is a little capsule. So I think a lot of people are used to thinking about, we have seen images of SpaceX capsules and the NASA missions. And it's very cramped. You are in there just so that there's enough room for you to function with all of the equipment right around you. And that's exactly the way that it is with this submersible as well. For me, it was a very comfortable experience because I've been in many of those types of submersibles before. But you do have windows or viewports to see outside, because that's a very important part of why you are going to make scientific observations. And for us, we were testing a prototype mapping instrument. And through the viewport, it's like a viewport in a space capsule. You see everything you see when you leave the atmosphere in a space capsule. And for us, we saw as we descended from the lit part of the ocean into complete darkness. We had a 4-hour descent to Challenger Deep, and it was very, very exciting, very wonderful. There's a lot of bioluminescence that you see in what's known as the twilight zone of the ocean with creatures flashing green and yellow lights communicating with each other. In fact, we even communicated with them by flashing the lights of our sub. And then when you get to the bottom, you hit the bottom in complete darkness and you are struck with the enormity and the hostility and the wonder of such a place that is not made for us. It's not made for human beings. We are visitors, but it is a place that is part of this planet that is our planet, and there are creatures that is their home. And you are struck with the enormity of that, that these creatures live in not only complete darkness, but under enormous pressure, that pressure that is such that were something to happen with our submersible, we would be, our life would be snuffed out in a matter of nanoseconds. And we unfortunately got a very horrible look at what that might be like with the Titan submersible tragedy. But that's a whole other discussion. At any rate, it was a wonderful, fantastic experience.
Tell us about the geospatial technology that you were employing and hope to employ in the future to map more of the ocean floor.
The wonderful thing about our submersible dive was that you can map the ocean floor and you can map conditions in the ocean, such as the ocean's temperature and salinity, with the little submersible. And the technology that we make at ESRI, the Geographic Information System technology, can take that data and give you a map of that. It can even give you a three-dimensional visualization that you can fly through. But that was not the only thing that we had available to us for mapping. The ship that deployed our submersible was able to do much broader scale mapping because it had instrumentation in its hull, attached to its hull, that actually created maps of ocean floor topography. And our technology, again, ArcGIS, is used to make those types of maps. In fact, it was the mapping data that was collected by the ship that was contributed to the Seabed 2030 Global Seafloor Mapping Initiative. Now, we had a prototype mapping instrument attached to the submersible, a tiny instrument that is normally used to discover shipwrecks. In fact, this was the same instrument that was used when the Endurance, Shackleton's Endurance, was discovered under the ice in Antarctica earlier that year, earlier in 2022. And our task was to see if we could take that instrument and operate it at deeper depths where normally that type of instrument implodes. And this particular instrument was created by Deep Ocean Search, a French and Mauritian company that was contracted by Caledon Oceanic for our submersible. And this type of instrument, it records the strength of acoustic signals coming back from the seafloor, and it turns those acoustic signals into white or gray areas in an image so that you can see what's on the seafloor. And we were very happy to have that instrument work, and we were able to do some mapping with it. And that will inform the next generation of that type of instrument for future surveys of the seafloor, and particularly for looking for downed planes or for shipwrecks or other types of infrastructure on the seafloor.
Let's talk about the whys of this. You know, you mentioned those few things, but what are some other reasons why it is important to map the seafloor?
Well, your radio show is one of the biggest reasons. It would be very difficult to have radio shows or podcasts without maps of the seafloor. To help your listeners wrap their minds around that, there are submarine cables across all of the world ocean, and these submarine cables account for about 95% of all intercontinental data traffic, including signals for radio shows and podcasts and streaming videos and phone calls and so forth. And we need seafloor maps just as we need maps to help us with our interstate highway system, especially if we're going to create new highways or new infrastructure. It's the same thing on the seafloor. And we must have really good accurate, detailed, extensive maps to do that for submarine cables. And similarly, we have other types of infrastructure on the seafloor that's really important for us. If you think about offshore energy infrastructure, so wind turbines, wind energy turbines, tidal energy structures, wave energy buoys, all of those pieces of infrastructure require accurate mapping, especially to assess the suitability of where to put those structures. Most of us, many of us like seafood. We love our fish. We love our shellfish. That too depends on mapping of the seafloor, especially the habitats of ground fisheries and shellfish. So fisheries management, commercial fishing, that's another reason for mapping the seafloor, restoring those habitats so that we have enough to fish, enough to eat sustainably. Related to that is conserving these areas of the ocean floor and the waters above them in terms of marine parks, marine reserves, siting and managing and monitoring marine protected areas is another great use of seafloor mapping. And here in California, we are very excited because a new marine sanctuary is coming very soon, the Chumash National Marine Sanctuary. That was suggested and fostered and brought to being by our Chumash indigenous communities on the central coast of California. There are many, many other uses for seafloor mapping. I'll mention one last use, which is public safety in terms of monitoring where waves are going to go from waves from storms or tsunamis. Once they feel the bottom of shallow waters, and once they hit the shore, hit the coastline, where those waves are going to go is governed by the topography, the seafloor topography right before they hit land. So the evacuation maps that are used to help people get to safety in the event of these catastrophic storms and the waves, that depends on ocean floor mapping.
And it's my understanding that really there's only a very small portion of the ocean floor that's been mapped at this point.
Yes, that's true. And this is the reason that we have the UN sponsored and endorsed Seabed 2030 project, because we are trying to get to 100% of the ocean floor mapped at the level of detail that we need for all of these uses. And we're only at 26.1% right now.
Now, personally, I want to talk to you a little bit about your personal journey and the significance for you as the first person of African descent to make a journey like this and to chart this path, really. Talk about the personal significance for you and for your mom, I understand as well.
Yes, the personal significance it is great. The first thing that you want to be able to do is to do your job to the best of your ability, no matter who you are. In fact, I've noticed this with Kamala Harris. She is not talking about being the first Black and Asian woman to be president. She's talking about how good of a president she will be if she were elected. It's the same thing for me with being a scientist. But at the same time, we are in a society where representation matters, representation must matter. And I'm a big fan of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. And I mention her because she's got a memoir that has just come out. And I remember following her very tough Senate nomination process, which eventually led to her becoming the first woman of African descent to be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that inspired me tremendously just to see that. And it's the same thing, I think, with young people who have seen or heard about my dive to Challenger Deep. It's still really significant to be the first. Now, that's a way to inspire and to encourage others, especially for little children, especially for young people, for girls and boys, and especially for our Black community to see that something like this is possible for them. And it's not off limits because they are Black. This is something that they can aspire to one day if they desire. And it doesn't have to be going to the bottom of the ocean. It can be other things that they aspire to. But I'm very mindful of that and thankful to my mother, who was a wonderful inspiration and cheerleader for me.
What's next for you?
What's next for me is actually getting involved in many initiatives that are at the interface of science to policy. I don't think there's another deep sea expedition in my future, although you never know, but that was a very special project, and I'm able to now use the results and the inspiration from that project in my work with the United Nations. ESRI is very, very involved with many United Nations programs, including this Seabed 2030 program, and especially in the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development, which is going on right now. And then there is also some work that is coming up with the State Department. I'm very, very pleased and honored to be a new U.S. science envoy for ocean sustainability for the U.S. State Department. And so my work with the State Department will start possibly next month with a trip to Africa, visiting the embassies and the government agencies there, along with State Department personnel, to help them aspire to their ocean sustainability goals.